And now, switching to our guest for the evening, and I'm really, really excited to have Cory Doctorow, and he's a Canadian sci-fi author, he's a blogger and copyright laws activist, and the most prominent topics of his books are digital rights, surveillance and resilience, and today he's here to talk for us and to you about free software and why it's so important to have that. Welcome, Cory Doctorow.
Thank you. Vielen Dank. excuse me. Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be able to talk to you. Thank you very much for staying up late to hear me in Austria. I know that after a long work day, there's nothing I like better than to relax and unwind by watching a video conference. So it's very kind of you. I really appreciate your patience and hanging in there. I'd like to offer my apologies in advance to the translators for the fact that I speak very quickly when I get excited, and this is a subject that excites me. And I will do my very best to speak at a measured pace that invites translation. But my apologies for the inevitable exuberance I will exhibit through the course of this talk. So the talk I'm going to give tonight is adapted from a column that I wrote in a magazine called Locus Magazine. It's the science fiction industry's trade magazine, and I'm a science fiction novelist. This is, you know, my latest book, The Third Little Brother book. And I write about whatever I want there, and I've been writing there for 14 years. And I started to have this, I don't know what you call it, like a revelation just before my last column was due. Normally they come in as a very short sort of 1,000-word typical column, and this one came in at much longer. It ended up filling about half the issue. And my editor was kind enough to run it verbatim. And I think it constitutes a real advance in how I conceive of some issues that are very near to my heart and that I've campaigned on for a long time. And I think that it very much touches on the themes of this conference and phrases things in a way that I had not heard them phrased before. And I was very lucky to be able to talk to a variety of experts while I was developing this column. Notably Pamela Samuelson, Zephyr Teachout, and Benjamin Mako Hill. And I'd like to acknowledge all of their contributions to this. So the column as it ran is called IP. The talk is called We Used to Have Cake and Now We've Barely Got Icing. I'm sure you know the term open source software. And if you are in the audience for this talk, you've probably heard of free software. And you might even know a little bit about the war of words between those two phrases and the ethical debate that underpins them. Now, I have been involved in these issues since the last century, but even I never really understood what was going on in the background until recently. I was researching the history of the first free software license and had a revelation that transformed the way that I think about all of this stuff. Here's some background. Free software has its origins with an AI researcher who became an activist named Richard Stallman, and he started the GNU, GNU project in 1983 and created the GNU General Public License, or GPL. The GPL is a copyright license for computer programmers who want to share their work. If you release a program's underlying code under the GPL, it means that everyone in the world is free to run your program, to study the code, to improve the code, and to share the improved code with others, provided that they apply the same license to it. The GPL is a copyright license for code, and it arrived almost at the same moment that copyright itself arrived for code. Before 1983, in the US, software was primarily viewed as a functional work, and functional works don't get copyright, only creative works do. But in 1983, a lawsuit called Apple versus Franklin, combined with some changes in the US Copyright Act that had been enacted in 1980, changed the way that the law worked so that it became widely understood that software could be copyrighted. And so when you chose to apply the GPL to your copyrighted code, you could lock it open and ensure that not only could others build on it, but that no one could take that code that you had released into the open and close it off again. Today, we think of the act of licensing code as free software as a mark of forbearance, a way for a software author to promise not to seek legal sanctions against people who create new programs that read and write their data, nor against those who fork off competing versions of their original program. To make your software free is to promise its users freedom. As the saying goes, you have made the code free as in speech, even if it's not necessarily free as in beer. In 1998, free software was reinvented. A group of more business-oriented technical people and entrepreneurs decided that the name free software was alienating the commercial sector, first because it stressed freedom, and second because it implied that the code must be free of charge, and therefore couldn't be directly commercialized. So these people coined a rival term, open source, stressing the instrumental benefits of allowing other people to scrutinize their code. Scrutineers could root out defects and prevent nefarious subversion of code to spy on or steal data from its users. As the saying went, with enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow. So let's go back to 1983 and the birth of free software. At that moment, when free software was born, software copyright was brand new, not widespread, and no one was sure how it worked, what it covered, and what it prohibited. Software patents were effectively unheard of and nearly impossible to secure. Terms of service, those shrink wrap licenses and other contracts that you agree to simply by running code or opening a box or taking some other mundane and unsuspecting steps, these were not considered enforceable. There were no laws against bypassing the copy controls that we sometimes call digital rights management or DRM. And certainly there were none of these weird, modern, exotic para-copyrights. For example, the one that Oracle is trying to establish by suing Google at the Supreme Court to say that an API is copyrightable. In other words, when free software was born, if you wanted to clone or interoperate with or improve or modify any existing software, all you needed to do was reverse engineer that software, and you were free to work. The GPL was not permission to make something new that was compatible with something that already existed. People who knew how to make software already behaved as though that was something that they were permitted to do, irrespective of the hurt feelings and anger of the companies or individuals whose code they were working with. The GPL was a request for companies and software authors to make this process easier and less tedious by getting them to hand out their source code so that interoperators could skip the wasteful and time-consuming reverse engineering business and get right to the good stuff, making new things that improve on or even competed with whatever had already been made. The GPL then was icing on the cake. Applying the GPL to your code, it didn't mean that you would forswear legal vengeance on people who wanted to make something compatible with your thing, because you had no right to that vengeance. Applying to the GPL signaled that you wanted to collaborate with your interoperators, rather than impotently shaking your fist at them from the sidelines as they went right ahead and interoperated with your code, no matter what your wishes. Now, 40 years ago, the world is a very different place. Between software copyrights, anti-circumvention rules, software patents, enforceable terms of service, trade secrecy, non-compete agreements, and this Google Oracle business, any attempt to interoperate with an existing product or service without permission from its corporate master is a legal suicide mission, an invitation to almost unlimited civil and even criminal litigation. That is to say, if you dare to modify, improve, or replace an existing dominant software-based product or service, you risk bankruptcy and even a long prison sentence. 40 years ago, we had cake and we asked for icing on top of it. Today, all we have left is the icing. We've forgotten that the cake was ever there. If your code isn't licensed as free, then it had best be left alone. So let me talk about what I mean when I say interoperability. This is a very nerdy and technical term, a little obscure. There are familiar, less technical versions like compatibility, but they don't quite get at what I mean when I say interoperability. In a technical sense, interoperability just means two products or services that somehow work together with one another. Think of opening up a Word document in Google Docs, or using third-party ink cartridges with your printer, or just replacing the band on your watch, or changing the stereo that came with your cart. Interoperability is this broad, universal, essential characteristic of all technology. And interoperability is the default state of the world. I barbecued some hamburgers last night in my charcoal barbecue. I got to use whatever charcoal I wanted. I didn't have to use the charcoal that the barbecue manufacturer had demanded. The light bulbs overhead, when I want to change them, I buy any light bulb and I screw it into the socket. When I put on my shoes, I wear any socks, not just the socks that the manufacturer has demanded that I wear. Now, some of this is because of standardization. Standardization is when manufacturers and academics and regulators and all of the other interested parties get together in these standards development organizations to make the process simpler. And they describe things like, say, for a light bulb, the canonical direction and spacing of the thread at the end of the light bulb. Or for a web browser, the syntax of an HTTP request. Or for a toilet, where the plumbing pipes go, how wide they are, and how they're spaced, so that you can just take your old toilet off and put a new toilet on. And this makes interoperability much smoother. Think about the standards for paper like this. A1, A2, A3, GSM, grams per square meter. These make it possible for you to buy any paper and have it work with your printer without requiring trimming or other modifications. And if we fail to standardize, life can be very hard for everyone. In early Australian history, the rail barons laid different gauges of railroad track across the country, leading to something that even today is called the marvelously named multi-gauge muddle, a rail system where some cars and some engines can't go on some tracks. Now, barriers to interoperability are not insurmountable. If paper doesn't fit in the envelope, you can fold it. If paper doesn't fit in the printer, you can cut it. If the rail gauge doesn't match the engine, you can modify its undercarriage so that it can switch between different kinds of rail. And there have been hundreds of inventions to do this in Australia, but they all turned out to be more expensive than just tearing up all the rail, which they're doing now. Interoperability lowers switching costs. That's the cost of leaving behind whatever you're using now in favor of something that you think will be better for you. My grandparents emigrated to Canada from the Soviet Union as refugees on a displaced persons boat, and they incurred a very high switching cost. Leaving the USSR in the 40s meant that you had no way to talk to the people that you left behind. And for more than a decade, my grandmother's only contact with her family in Leningrad was through unreliable word of mouth from the rare instances in which other people in Canada got travel visas that let them visit the city. Now, 5 years ago, I moved from the United Kingdom here to Los Angeles. And here in Los Angeles, 5 years later, we are in routine contact with my family in London and in Wales and in Toronto. My laptops, my books, they all came with me, as did all of our other personal effects. Now, we left behind most of our appliances because of the differences in voltage, but there were some appliances I really liked, like my theremin, and I just bought an adapter that lets me use it here. Companies really like high switching costs. For a would-be monopolist, the products that are best are the ones that are easy to start using and hard to move away from. Purdue Pharma is notorious today for being the company that commercialized OxyContin, the opioid that kicked off the opioid epidemic. And now that they have been sued and targeted by leakers, we know how they talked about their product internally. And those leaked and disclosed memos reveal executives rubbing their hands together and cackling at how easy it is to start using opioids and how hard it is to stop. Now, addiction is not the only way to create barriers to switching. Facebook, for example, makes it incredibly easy to get started. Historically, they even engaged in deceptive tactics to get you to share your address book with them so that when you opened your first Facebook page, you were already friended with all the people in your address book. And once you're on Facebook, Facebook sucks in articles from the public web and lets you use Facebook as your portal to the rest of the internet. You can start on Facebook using it just to follow the friends that also have Facebook accounts. But over time, it also nudges you to follow your friends on rival networks like Twitter by using Facebook as your interface to read those web feeds. But when you want to leave Facebook, there is no easy way to do so. You can't go to one of Facebook's rivals and follow what your friends are posting to Facebook from there. And you certainly can't reply to those messages from a rival to Facebook. Interoperability is the thing that Facebook uses to slurp in all that stuff from the open web. And it's the key to self-determination. Leaving Facebook in the 21st century, it's like my grandmother leaving the USSR in the 40s. You can go, but your friends and your loved ones are all hostages behind Zuckerberg's Iron Curtain. So leaving Facebook means leaving behind your communities and your relationships. I'm not going to say that that's as hard as getting off opioids once you've been addicted, but it's not easy either. And you have to remember that the fact that you're on Facebook means that you are a hostage that is keeping someone else from leaving. Now, here's the thing. Everybody wants to minimize their risks, whether they're employers or workers, whether they're big tech or technology users. You want to use Google in ways that make your life better, and you don't want Google to be able to arbitrarily change or remove the services that it provides in ways that make your life worse. I am still angry that Google removed Google Reader, its flagship RSS product that I relied on every day. Now, Google wants to ensure that you won't leave the company and stop using its products and services. It could do this by making sure that you are so delighted with those products and services that you don't even consider leaving. But a surer, cheaper, and more reliable way is to interweave its products and services with your life, making sure that your kid can't go to public school without having a Google Classroom account, embedding Google Search in your mobile operating system, releasing web and app development frameworks for third parties that quietly harvest the data of their users and send them to Google, meaning that whether or not you know it, you're still a Google user. Now, the more freedom you have to leave Google, the bigger a risk you present to Google. The more Google can lock you in, the lower the risk of your departure from the service, the higher the risk that Google will cease to keep your business by making the best products it can, and instead depend on being able to retain you because you can't leave or because leaving comes at a high price. Interoperability improves self-determination by safeguarding your ability to change your current situation in incremental steps. Say you like your phone and the apps that you have, but an app that's been banned in its default app store is one that you want to use. Interoperability comes to the rescue here. You could add a second app store to your phone's list of approved software. You get to keep your phone, you get to keep your apps, you get to keep all the data on your phone, and you get to use that app that the manufacturer doesn't want you to have. Without interoperability, the choice is take it or leave it. If the app store blocks the app that you want, the price of getting that app is throwing away your phone, all of its apps, some or all of the data that you've painstakingly put into your phone. That app had better be a pretty damn good app. Otherwise, no one is going to start using it. Writ large, interoperability is democracy. When someone says they like the city but not its local laws, we don't tell them that the law is the law, and if you don't like the law, get out of the city. Instead, we set out processes by which local laws can be amended or repealed by the people who are chafed by them. And if you fail in your bid to change your city's law, and you decide that you want to go to another city, you can stay friends with the people that you've left behind. You can bring your things with you. Interoperability lets you replace the laws and keep your house, or replace your house and go find new laws. Now, all of this started with a reflection on the history of free software and the largely forgotten time in which the default condition of software was freedom. In the absence of copyright, patent, anti-circumvention, terms of service, non-competes, confidentiality, and all those other commonplaces of today's software marketplace, anyone who could figure out how to reverse engineer a program could improve it, replace some or all of it, read or write its files, compete with it, or sideline it. Today, this is no longer the case. In fact, today's software marketplace is so unlike this previous cake and icing world, where the default was software freedom, the cake. And free software movement came along and made its audacious demand for freely reusable source code as a means of making that freedom as frictionless as possible. When they asked for icing, it's virtually impossible to imagine that environment today. The thicket of anti-interoperability rules that have sprung up around interoperability has a catch-all name. We call it intellectual property. Now, free software advocates and free culture advocates hate the term intellectual property. The argument against intellectual property is in two pieces. First, the argument says that the term is imprecise. And second, it says that it's dishonest. So let's talk about imprecision. Prior to the rise of the term intellectual property as an umbrella term, if you wanted to talk about one of the things that encompasses, you would just name it. When you were talking about copyright, you said copyright. And when you were talking about patents, you said patents. Bunching together copyrights and trademarks and patents and all these other rules, it wasn't particularly useful since they were all very different. On rare instances in which you had to talk about all of them together, usually you call them the creator's monopolies or the author's monopolies. Now, the anti-intellectual property argument isn't just about the imprecision. It's about the rhetorical dishonesty, about the differences, the really important differences between different forms of IP. So in terms of copyright, you have different reasons for it in different places, but broadly you have two big regimes. You have the regime from France, the Berne Convention, and you have the regime from America. And both of them, despite some profound differences, talk about providing an incentive to create and not allowing for that incentive to grow so large that it chokes off future creation. Both of them contain limitations and exceptions, and both of them are designed to provide just enough incentive to create and no more. Neither of them cover ideas. Both of them only cover the expressions of ideas. Now, patents are completely different from copyrights. Patents are a trade-off. What patents seek to do is to get inventors to describe how their inventions work rather than keeping them a secret, so that other inventors can study those inventions and make new ones, even ones that compete with them. So to get a patent, you have to submit a working model or a diagram of how your invention works. And that diagram or model has to be so detailed that anyone who studies it can figure out how it works. And that means that they can make a new product that competes with it without violating your patent. Trademarks are completely different altogether. The origin of trademarks is in consumer protection. The idea is that if someone is deceptively marketing a product or service in a way that misleads the customers for it, we can deputize the manufacturer of that product or service to sue their rival, not on their own behalf, but on behalf of their users. So if Coca-Cola has the right to sue another company over the use of the word Coke, it is only to the extent that that company is tricking Coke drinkers into drinking something other than Coke. If someone uses the word Coke in a way that lowers Coca-Cola's profits, but doesn't deceive a Coke drinker, Coke's trademarks are no good. Coke has no recourse under trademark. So you can see that these are three completely different regimes, and calling them one thing, intellectual property, it doesn't make any sense. It's so imprecise that it invites all kinds of intellectual mischief. When you say, oh, my idea has intellectual property protection, what do you mean? Do you mean that your expression is covered, but not the idea, and only to the extent that it provides an incentive? Or that you've disclosed how the machine works so that other people can make interoperable products or replicate its functionality? Or that you have the right to sue rivals who deceive your customers with bad marketing. Now, all of that being said, when you actually look at how people in industry use the term IP, there is a very precise, if colloquial, definition that completely covers all of the ways in which it's used. And it's this: IP is any law that I can invoke that allows me to control the conduct of my competitors, my critics, and my customers. So let me say that again, because that is the core here. IP is any law that I can invoke that allows me to control the conduct of my competitors, my critics, and my customers. That is, in this uncertain world where other people can unpredictably take actions that erode your profits, mire you in scandal, or even tank your business, IP is a way of forcing other people to arrange their affairs to suit your needs, even if it doesn't suit their needs. There are some ways in which this is undeniably true. Think of digital rights management, DRM. These are the digital locks on our devices that are designed to prevent us from using them in ways that we prefer. Your printer uses DRM to force you to buy ink that the manufacturer has approved. Your phone uses DRM to force you to use apps that its manufacturer has approved. Ventilators from companies like Medtronic and tractors from companies like John Deere use DRM to force you to get them serviced by the manufacturer's representatives. And if they decide that it's too late to service them and they can't be salvaged, those DRM locks force you to get rid of them and buy a new one. Copyright laws, that is, IP laws, ban tampering with DRM, making it a serious felony to provide others with the tools to bypass DRM. America pioneered this in 1998 with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and its Section 1201. But by 2001, the European Union had followed suit with Article 6 of the Copyright Directive. Canada followed suit with Bill C-32. And other countries around the world, most recently Mexico on July the 1st, have passed laws that contain substantially similar provisions. All of these laws indiscriminately ban breaking DRM. Now, these are copyright laws, but the ban on breaking DRM is not limited to copyright infringement. Bypassing DRM to get your printer to accept third-party ink is not a copyright violation. You're not copying the code in your printer. You're not copying the traces of its circuit boards. But even though you don't break copyright when you jailbreak your phone, you still break copyright law. The law bans legal conduct if you have to break DRM to engage in it. So the law is not intended to protect copyright. It's intended to protect businesses. It's not felony copyright infringement. It's felony contempt of business model. And it's not just DRM. Take the font Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs is a free font released by the global financial criminals Goldman Sachs. Now, they give the font away for free, but it comes with a license. And in the license is a non-disparagement clause through which you promise that you will not use the font to criticize Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs does not need copyright to stop you from reproducing its font. It gives the font away for free and it wants it reproduced. Goldman Sachs needs copyright so that it can boss you around, so that it can tell you what you must and must not say. Now, these risks to free expression and self-determination, they've always been latent in copyright and patent and trademark. And each of these laws was historically designed to have these minimization tools to allow to keep that risk from overtaking the utility of the law. Each of these escape valves theoretically stops IP owners from using their rights to take away your rights. So in copyright, we have fair dealing and limitations and exceptions, which allow for many kinds of copying, adapting, displaying, and even selling other people's copyrighted works, provided that these activities promote free and robust discourse by transforming, commenting on, or analyzing copyrighted work. Fair dealing does not depend on a copyright owner's permission. Fair dealing is there for you to use when you don't have permission. Patent has its own escape valve, publication. to get a patent, you have to tell people how your invention works. And so other people can study it and make rival products that don't conflict with your patent. And trademark has its own escape valves. First is the narrowness of trademark, that it only protects against deceptive uses. And second is something called the nominative defense, where it's not a violation of trademark to use a trademark to describe the thing that the trademark is associated with. You can put a sign in your shop window that says, "We fix iPhones." You can put a sign on your printer ink that says, "Works with HP printers." You can put a sign on your soft drink machine that says, "This tastes better than Coke." And there's nothing the trademark holder gets to do about it. Now, these escape valves were around for a very long time, but they turned out to be very brittle. It turns out that much of the efficacy of these escape valves depends on there being real competition. So that when one company tries to narrow fair dealing, for example, other companies that depend on fair dealing will show up to fight for a more expansive definition and produce an equilibrium that protects us. Through 4 decades of massive consolidation in every industry, a consensus has emerged in the global shareholder and managerial classes that these escape valves are defects in otherwise exemplary laws. And these entities have set to work creating legal precedents, new laws, and new legal tactics to jam the escape valve shut and break off the handle. This is how we went from having software freedom cake to just having the icing. New copyright laws, like the ones that prohibit breaking DRM. New copyright precedents, like the one that Oracle is seeking against Google. And new tactics for combining copyrights, patents, trademarks, DRM, trade secrets, and other IP, so that if trademark permits something, copyright will block it. And if copyright will permit something, patent will block it, and so on, until all the certainty has been moved onto the manufacturer's side of the deal, and all the risk has been moved onto yours. Recall that the term of art that we used before IP was the author's monopoly. Now, there are lots of versions of how we went from calling it author's monopolies to IP, but the one thing that everyone agrees is that being called a monopolist is no fun. And so if you were someone who felt that your rights weren't being respected and the only way to get them to be reformed was to go to Parliament or Congress and say, "My monopoly isn't big enough," that you would get a not very good hearing. And so it was much easier for people to be able to ask for help defending their property, and the term intellectual property became widespread. Now, there is a strict sense in which copyright and other IP rights are monopolies. When you write down a collection of words, when I wrote down this essay, a new copyright was born, and it gave me the exclusive right to reproduce, adapt, display, perform, or sell the essay. My rivals can compete with me by writing different essays that they hope to sell to the same magazines and tempt the same readers with, but me and I alone can sell the essay that I wrote. In that sense, I obviously have a monopoly. I'm in a market with only one seller. That is the purest monopoly that there is. But in competition law, that's not what we mean when we say monopoly. We don't mean a company that has 100% of the market. We mean someone a monopolist when they have market power, that is, the power to set prices. After HP sells you a printer, it can charge whatever it wants for the ink. You could just throw away the printer and buy another one, but all of HP's rivals also charge over the odds for their ink, and they also use DRM and IP to punish competitors who introduce cheap ink into the market. The people who get angry when we call them monopolists for having copyrights, they're not wrong. It's a rare author who has market power. Authors, even best-selling authors, have limited power to convince publishers to pay more. There are a few superstar exceptions, but they're as rare as meteor strikes. Overwhelmingly, copyright does not give a creator market power. However, there are actual market power monopolies in the entertainment industry. For example, the world right now has about one movie theater chain, AMC, that dominates the majority of screens and is on the verge of bankruptcy. The world has 3 major record labels. It has 4 major movie studios and 5 major publishers. there's one national brick and mortar bookstore chain left in the United States, and there is a single global online digital bookseller that dominates most bookselling. How did these monopolies emerge? Well, in some ways, these monopolies over creative work came from the same place as all the other monopolies that we're contending with today. We, after all, live in a world of monopolistic energy, eyewear, finance, accounting, aerospace, civil engineering, logistics, and so on. And the way that those came about was from lax anti-monopoly enforcement. For 40 years, we have allowed companies to grow by buying small companies before they could grow to be major competitors, to merge with existing major competitors and stop competing with them, and to create vertical monopolies that they can use to squeeze their workers, their customers, and their suppliers. But entertainment monopolies aren't quite the same as these other monopolies because they aggregate authors' monopolies alongside their market power monopolies. These monopolies, these hybrid monopolies of market power and authors' monopoly, are durable in a way that just market power monopolies are not. Say you're Universal Music and you control one third of all the music that musicians might want to sample. You have a bottleneck that can only be evaded, or that cannot be evaded through creativity or cunning. And to break that monopoly is a copyright infringement. And if you try to make money off of it at commercial scale, it's a criminal copyright infringement, and people can go to jail. That is to say, if you have a monopoly in banking or aerospace, you have to worry about getting sued for your monopolistic conduct. But if you are an entertainment monopoly, you get to sue anyone who tries to compete with you, anyone who tries anything pro-competitive. The result is a monopoly that controls access to distribution channels. Oops, I managed to not print out my whole speech. One second, I'll just pull it up on my screen. Sorry about that. That's embarrassing. I must have run out of paper and not even noticed.
Oh, no problems. Going so much wrong on our side. So everything is totally fine. And I can just tell people on the stream that they still have the possibility to ask us questions via privacyweek.at/ask.
Very good. And I'm back. I've got my speech in front of me now. Thank you. The result is a monopoly that controls access to distribution channels and audiences that can invoke the power of the state to fine or even imprison people who seek to challenge their monopoly. And tech has disrupted this, but even where tech challenges monopolies, it does so in the service of creating more monopolies. Kindle Unlimited, for example, represents a real challenge to traditional publishing. And every Kindle Unlimited book is released with DRM that locks it to Amazon's platform. Any attempt to liberate a Kindle Unlimited book so it can be read on a rival's device or with a device designed to stop Amazon from spying on you while you read involves breaking the DRM. And that involves committing a felony under Section 1201 of the DMCA or Article 6 of the EUCD. Kindle Unlimited books are not sold to libraries. And giving a librarian a tool to remove DRM so they can add a Kindle Unlimited book to their collection is a jailable offense. As Amazon conquers an ever larger proportion of genre readers, it permanently locks those readers to its platform, meaning that any author who wants access to those readers has to do so on Amazon's terms, turning over the power of their author's monopoly to be used in Amazon's market power monopoly arsenal. Give authors more copyright, a stronger monopoly, and Amazon will just take that too, as a condition of reaching the audience Amazon has imprisoned in its walled garden. Authors' monopolies are not market power monopolies, and just because you have a copyright, it doesn't mean you're a monopolist. But if you can aggregate enough authors' monopolies in one place, you can turn them into a market power monopoly, backed by the power of the courts and the prisons, and it accumulates more authors' monopolies every time someone enters your captive marketplace. We're getting to the end here. And I think you've probably heard the quote from the founder of Netscape, Marc Andreessen, that software is eating the world. And with all due respect to Mr. Andreessen, I want to say that that's not true. Software has already eaten the world. If there was any doubt, the pandemic has erased it. Here we are, locked down, viewing the world through our screens. There can no longer be any distinction between human rights and digital rights. There's no software freedom. There's only freedom. Software is expanding relentlessly into every device and system, from ventilators to tractors, from toothbrushes to sex toys, from refrigerator filters to money itself. And where we find software, we find IP, that is, software deployed to control the conduct of competitors, critics, and customers in such a way that overlapping systems of laws can be invoked to punish anyone who bypasses that software. The combination of software and IP in every device is a sea change in the organization of our society. As firms have become increasingly concentrated, as monopolies have emerged in every sector, they have figured out how to infuse their products with just enough software that they can invoke IP to control their competitors, their critics, and their customers. These are market power monopolies backstopped by creators' monopolies, which create IP rights that supercharge market power. And all of this is just the beginning, because software isn't just a way to put IP into otherwise inert objects. It's also a way to automate them, to make them into unblinking, ever-vigilant enforcers of the manufacturer's interests. They can detect and interdict any attempt at unauthorized interoperability and call the appropriate authorities to punish the offenders. This is a level of control beyond the wildest dreams of history's most sociopathic monopolists. Think of the coal boss who controls his workers by moving them into company housing in a company town where they're paid in company scrip that can only be spent at the company store. This coal boss moves titanic amounts of risk off of his balance sheet and onto his workers. Not only are they incapable of leaving for a better job without paying their debts, but they're also paid in non-interoperable proprietary money that only works in the company's store, where prices can be adjusted at will to ensure that those debts are never paid off. But even that coal boss, a god to his workers, was never all-powerful. A coal worker could buy some corn at the company store and trade it for real dollars at the local moonshiner shed, converting non-interoperable scrip to interoperable dollars at a loss through the intermediary exchange medium of starch. Think of a worker paid in company scrip today. The digitally enabled smart goods that they buy at their company store can be locked to their accounts the way that a Kindle book or an iPhone app is locked to your personal device. The unblinking eye of the software enforcement system is always watching, ready to discipline you for your lack of consideration for the shareholder's bottom line. Once we had cake, today we have icing. And at this rate, the icing will be gone before long. There are no longer digital rights, only human rights. There is no longer software freedom. There's only human freedom. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for this very, very interesting and really broadband talk about the topic of IP and everything that can go wrong with that. I'm an author, and I know the part of the book market that has lots of problems with that. Yeah. We got a question, or more like a statement, but I want to hand it in because it's really...
It's always a statement and not a question.
It always is. But it's a nice one, I thought. So the question or the statement is, maybe there's a misunderstanding here. We don't want a bigger piece of the cake. We want the whole bakery.
I think that's so. And I think it gets to something that gives me cause for hope, which is that we are at a moment globally where people are starting to recognize that what they thought of was a local issue is in fact part of a wider trend. So there are people who are really angry about the finance sector and the way that it dominates our policymaking. Particularly under conditions of austerity, particularly now during the coronavirus pandemic. And there are people who are really angry about their glasses because all the glasses in the world now are made by one company, Luxottica in Italy, that also owns all the high street retailers like Lens Crafters and Sunglass Hut, all of the brands, so Dolce & Gabbana and Oliver Peoples, and all of the major labs, Essilor, and the major eyewear insurer. And they've raised prices 1,000% in a decade. And there are some people who are angry because they're professional wrestling fans. And 30 years ago, there were 20 professional wrestling leagues, and now there's just one. And the billionaire who owns it has reclassified all of the performers as contractors and taken away their medical insurance. And they're dying in their 50s of work-related injuries and begging on GoFundMe for pennies. These people think that they're fighting about something different. You know, whether you think you're fighting about the energy sector's sabotage of climate action for 40 years, or you think you're fighting about the fact that the big four accounting firms have allowed the largest companies in the world to rip off their workers and governments. But these are all part of the same fight. They're part of the anti-monopoly fight. And it reminds me of what life was like in the 70s before we had the term ecology. Before the term ecology, there were people who cared about owls, and there were people who cared about the ozone layer. And it's not like they were enemies, but they didn't think of themselves as being on the same side. The term ecology turned 1,000 issues into one movement with 1,000 ways to get involved. And we are now on the cusp of a realization that this oligarchic, plutocratic, and corrupted regulatory regime that we live in, where companies get away sometimes with literal murder, is the result of our decision 40 years ago to stop enforcing anti-monopoly law in Europe, in the US, in Canada, and in most of the rest of the world. And that has resulted in this situation where all of our industries have been dominated by a handful of firms.
We do have 10 more minutes, and I do have a few more questions. So sure. This is a long one. I hope you get that. So do you think that methods like DRM are the result of an unwillingness or being unable to change their business or better suit the digital domain where copying is more or less free?
I think that is the story that they tell about DRM, that if they have DRM, it allows them to, then they don't have to figure out how to adapt to a digital world where before they sold records and now they have to sell services around music. Except I don't think that's what's actually happening. When you look at how firms use DRM, it's not to prevent copying. They know that there's going to be copying. What it is to prevent lawful conduct. So think, for example, of, in fact, from the very earliest days of DRM, the first DRM systems that were protected by DRM laws were DVD players and games consoles. And so a DVD player, the main use of DRM in it was to enforce region coding. So if you were in Europe and you visited America on holiday and you went to Times Square and you went to Tower Records and you bought a DVD and you brought it home, it wouldn't play. Now, going to a store and buying a copyrighted work at the price that the creator has set, and then experiencing that copyright work in your private home, is not a copyright infringement. It's the actual opposite of a copyright infringement, right? That is what copyright is supposed to enable. So the DRM from the very start, right, from the first laws created to protect DRM in the mid 90s, DRM existed not to prevent copying, but to prevent lawful activity, including sometimes lawful copying like format shifting, but primarily lawful activity like, in the case of consoles, buying direct from authors. So the Sega Dreamcast, you know, which was one of the first DRM-equipped consoles, you would buy CDs, games on CD for your Sega Dreamcast, but to get those CDs, for those CDs to work, they had to be stamped at a special plant that Sega controlled. And Sega charged the software vendors, the games programmers, to stamp their CDs. And they charged a lot more than it would cost to get a regular CD duplicated. And they used a little bit of encryption to make sure that when you put the disc in, that it came from Sega's official factory to make sure that Sega got their kickback for the disc. Now, if I own a Sega Dreamcast and you make a Sega game, and I buy that game from you and put it in my Sega, that is the literal opposite of copyright infringement, right? Whether or not we give Sega some money for me playing your game is irrelevant. It is not a copyright infringement for a copyright author and a copyright audience member to exchange money in order to use the products of that copyright author's mind. And so what we have is a situation or a system that is designed not to enforce copyright law, but to create an entirely new private regime of law, where if you skin a device with just enough DRM to invoke an anti-DRM law, a DRM protection law, then using that device in ways that you prefer, that your customers prefer, can become a crime, right? And so rather than going to Congress or Parliament or the European Parliament saying, it should be illegal to bring a DVD home from America and watch it, you can just add DRM and then invoke Article 6 of the EUCD and say, irrespective of whether it's legal to watch this disc, you're not allowed to watch this disc. And when European countries enacted the EUCD, they were pretty clear that that was the intent. And you know, even the exceptions that they carved out really made a mockery of the idea that there were parts of the copyright bargain that belonged to the public. So I debated the Norwegian minister who adopted, who was in charge of the implementation of the EUCD. Obviously, Norway's not an EU country, but they're in the customs union. They have to adopt European regulations. And the way that they structured their law had an exception for people who are visually disabled, as the directive insists. And the way that that exception was structured is that if you were blind or visually disabled, you yourself were allowed to buy, say, an Adobe ebook and then reverse engineer the file format, find a defect in Adobe security model, crack the ebook, and run it through an assistive device like a text-to-speech or braille reader. But you weren't allowed to ask for anyone's help. You weren't allowed to give help to anyone else, and you weren't allowed to give that book to another blind person to use once you'd removed the DRM from it. So it was pretty clear from the very start that this law was about allowing companies to trample every single limitation in statute on their behavior. Even if the limitation was one that said you must not discriminate against people who are blind, the copyright directive trumped that by allowing companies to structure their products so that although as a blind person you were entitled to read the book, you were in no way able to read the book.
Sounds great. What the heck?
Yeah, it's terrible. I mean, I couldn't believe it when I heard this minister say it. And people in the audience were just sort of laughing nervously, like, is that what he's saying? And that was what he was saying. But look at today, right? Libraries have a statutory right to buy and circulate books, right? That's not only is that older than copyright, it's actually like older than printing, right? Mm-hmm. It's older than paper. Libraries predate paper. We had papyrus libraries before we had paper libraries. And yet Amazon will not sell its Audible audiobooks or its Kindle ebooks to libraries at any price. People get very upset with Macmillan, and I think rightly so, for charging too much to libraries or putting onerous conditions on libraries for ebooks. They're my publisher. I'm not happy about it. But Amazon won't sell it to them at all. And there is a statutory right for libraries to purchase and circulate books that is in the law. But Amazon can circumvent the law. They can create a new regime of private law by adding just enough DRM. Like, it's not like it's hard to remove the DRM from an Amazon ebook. You just type, how do I remove Kindle DRM into a search engine? And it will tell you how to remove the DRM. Or if you're too lazy, go to a file sharing site and download a copy that someone else has removed the DRM from. So the DRM does no good at preventing copying. What it does is it allows for the invocation of the new rights, the right to control competitors, critics, and customers in order to limit their conduct. And so I think it's dangerous to say that the problem here is that these old men who run these giant companies don't understand digital. They understand digital, right? This is like the defense of, you know, the Ronald Reagan, when he was getting, you know, busted for Iran-Contra, and they were saying, why did you sell cocaine to get guns to give to the Contras who were tying nuns to trees and bayoneting them? And Reagan was like, I'm just an old man. I don't really remember. I'm a little confused. Is it time for my tea? Right? And people were like, oh, grandpa, you didn't know what you were doing when you arranged for those nuns to be bayoneted, right? Let us not say of these entertainment companies that they failed to adapt to digital. They saw very clearly what digital could mean for them. And they saw that it could mean a world in which they are no longer constrained by law that is created by democratic institutions, and where instead they could create law and hand them out to democratic institutions. Because governments, government libraries, government institutes, government hospitals that want to fix their ventilators can't fix their ventilators without breaking DRM, right? So this creates a system of software freedom that adheres only to large corporations. The rest of us have open source, right? If you want to look at the source code, you can go to GitHub. It's all there, right? If you want to change how it works, if you want software freedom, you've got to become a senior executive at the company. So, you know, this is the ultimate vindication, I think, of the software freedom side in this battle that seems so stupid and pointless to so many of us for so long, is that it actually does make a difference. Freedom is different from openness. We have a lot of openness right now. We have very little freedom.
Too true to be nice, yeah. I would give you one more question, and then we actually do have several people who would be totally willing to have a break sure. time chat with you. So right. We do have a link to a break time room on our streaming website, streaming.privacyweek.at, and there you find the Pausenraum, pause room, break time room. The last question that I would like to hand you in is, do you think DRM and IP protection will increase in the future, or might the open source movement gonna get more momentum and gain foothold in our society?
So I think that the open source movement can't, but maybe the human rights movement can, the free software movement can. I mean, Android is open source and full of DRM. They are combinations of things like code signing and lock-in and patents, these overlapping regimes, as I described, where copyright permits something, but then trademark stops it, then trademark permits it, and then patent comes in to stop it. That system effectively obviates open source. So what we have to do is rally around free software, not as a collection of licenses, but as an ethical proposition, right? That what we have to say is we need software freedom irrespective of the licensing regimes. You know, it's not enough to have, you know, source code if you are bound by terms of service that prevent you from using that source code in ways that will enhance interoperability and self-determination. And I think that the best chance we have of that is a very broad instrument. When we look at things like the Google Oracle case, which is, you know, very big and really not getting enough attention because it's so boring, but it's so important. The Google Oracle case shows you that when you have a monopoly, you get a lot of extra money, and you can take some of that money and mobilize it to change the law. And so monopolies accelerate themselves. They're a flywheel that gets faster and faster. And any exception that we make to copyright or patent or trademark or trade secrecy or any of the other regimes could be eventually overtaken by an expensive legal maneuver in some other domain. Maybe it'll become a non-compete agreement. Maybe it will become some other form of regulatory blockage that allows a firm to maintain its monopoly. Because remember that a monopolist's first preference is to be unregulated, and its second preference is to be regulated in a way that only it can comply with and that none of its competitors can comply with, because then it becomes a regulated monopoly, a monopoly that is eternally enshrined through regulation. And so I think what we need is a simple and blunt instrument that I call the interoperators defense. And it would be a law that would come through in Europe, I think through a regulation, a Europe-wide regulation. Here in the US, we could do it through national legislation. And it would say, notwithstanding any other law, including but not limited to patents, trade secrecy, copyright, non-compete and trademark, and so on and so on, it is not an offense, nor is it ever an offense, for someone to modify, improve, repair, extend, adapt, or make interoperable an existing product or service in a way that does not violate any other law. So, you know, if it violates the GDPR, it's illegal. If it doesn't, it's not, on behalf of a bona fide user. And so it will still require judges to interpret it, because you'll have to know whether it violates another law. You'll have to know whether the user is bona fide. But we will move from the system we have today, where the questions that judges answer are procedural. Did you violate a patent? And into one where they're policy. Did you act on behalf of a legitimate user for a socially beneficial purpose? Those cases will be fact intensive. They will be difficult to try. But they will reframe the issue and create a body of case law around the priority, which is self-determination, interoperability, and fairness, rather than access to source code, rather than copyright and its contours, rather than patent infringement and so on, so that we're really talking about what matters and not a proxy for what matters.
Thank you. Thank you very much for being here, for being a wonderful, great addition to our humble conference, which, by the way, is totally run on open source software and completely done by volunteers. So we do 7 days of program for you and all the people out there, including translations, including ops, including moderators, presenters, including so many people behind the scenes that are working on open source software to make the world a better place, hopefully. So thank you, Cory Doctorow.
Thank you. Vielen Dank. It's like my full German vocabulary right there.
It is great already.
Yeah, no, I grew up speaking Yiddish, so I speak terrible Middle-Deutsch.
Oh, but very interesting. Yeah. I think thank you again